Hello there, welcome to Back on the Ball, brought to you very kindly by Wallen Solicitors and Greenwood Accountancy. And once again, we're taking a look back at the world of football. Dean Edwards is sat in front of me. Dino, what were you doing 40 years ago?
I can't remember what I was doing 4 days ago. Never mind 40 years ago. Yeah, 40 years ago, I'd gone to Finland, basically. I'd just been released by Shrewsbury Town at 21, and then I moved out to Finland for a couple of years.
What's the game like over there? Cold, probably.
Well, it was strange because, obviously, I didn't study geography that well at school. I had to go to the library, find out where it was. And then when we landed on the plane, there must have been 12 feet of snow. And by the time we got off the plane, they'd moved it. I know they complain about the weather over here in England, but over there, they're just efficient. It's gone. But the first training session I ever had there, all the lads turned up in like, well, they were boots, but they got like spikes on, which worried me a little bit. And all their tracksuit bottoms were like shredded. And I thought, oh. Anyway, I didn't realise until the first tackle, I found out what it was. They went straight through the back of me, nearly broke my legs. And I thought, Jesus. And they're rough lads, the Scandinavians, big, strong lads.
So when was the season? Surely you didn't go through the winter.
The pre-season starts in March, and they start the season in April, and it goes through to the end of September. Yeah, it's opposite to what we get. So basically, when I came back, you know, I was playing all year round for a good two seasons. You know, I never had a break.
Wow. Cold, harsh, unfriendly. It's a bit like Dudley.
Oh, Dudley's much better than that. Saying that at the moment, it's probably not, because the weather's not great, is it?
Actually, it does worry me. How many pitches, how many council pitches, how many smaller clubs are suffering at the moment? Two games I was supposed to be going to, and one rugby match, gone. I'm never likely to come back either.
No, well, I was amazed the other day because I believe that Torquay was supposed to be playing at Plymouth Parkway when they played Truro in a league match. And then I found out they were playing at Gloucester, which was bizarre because I'm thinking, well, Truro, Torquay, playing at Gloucester, surely they could have played at Exeter City's ground. It just made sense, especially when they're both financially in dire straits at the moment. But to travel all the way up to Gloucester was just, I don't know who thought that one out, but they certainly haven't thought it through well.
Well, it may just have been logistics. You can't play two matches on one pitch in 1 week because the ground is so badly churning up at the moment. I've said it before and I'll say it again. If my rugby club is listening, think about growing rice. It's a valuable crop. You can do it on the touchline. Move on. We have a very special guest here with us today. I am so glad that John Uzel has managed it. John, welcome to the podcast. But what were you doing 40 years ago?
Well, 40 years ago yesterday, we were playing in the semi-final of the FA Cup. So, and we were playing it to Villa Park. We're beaten on the day, but that's where we were. And that's and yesterday at Home Park, it was a celebration of that event, which went very successfully.
Well, it was a huge success. I know, yeah, it didn't go the way things were planned. But to get there, what an effort. What was the atmosphere like 40 years ago?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the thing was, we were only a third division side. And we'd beaten Derby and we'd beaten West Brom, who were first division sides back in the day, which would be the equivalent to Premier League sides now. Looking back, it was 42,000-43,000. Wow. In Villa Park, and the atmosphere was amazing. 20,000 Argo fans up there, and the colours with the reds and the yellows of Watford and the green of Argo. It was a really special occasion.
Actually, Watford have turned Plymouth's life upside down several times. Strong side, very, always have been.
Yeah, and of course, at that time, John Barnes was playing for Watford just before he went to Liverpool. So, yeah, they had some very, very good players. Mo Johnson was up front, Nigel Stevenson. And it was like, you know, it's just one of those occasions where we'd done ever so well. We thought we were going to go all the way. But unfortunately, just at the, you know, in the last effort there in the semi-final, we lost 1-0.
But the day itself, how did it feel like running out there? We were talking about Wembley, running out onto Wembley's pitch. That is so off-putting for some players.
Yeah, I mean, if I talk through the quarterfinal, which was against Derby, we played at Home Park. There was 36,000 people at Home Park. When I ran out of the tunnel, the hair on the back of my neck stood up. It's just like electric. But there's something about playing, which, and I think this applies to most people, you know, who've been involved playing-wise in football with big crowds. 1 minute you're out there, if you've got time to think about the crowd, you ain't doing your job.
No.
So the expectation before the game, all the build-up, that's where all the excitement comes. That's where all the nervousness comes. But once you go in the dressing room, put your kit on, once you've got those boots on and you're walking down the tunnel to go out, I think there's, I don't know whether Dean feels the same, but when you step over that line, something else happens. You've got a job to do and you're totally focused on that. And I don't think you can think about the crowd at that point. It's only before the game, after the game, when the crowd really come into, you know, or back in the situation. I mean, obviously the volume is there when you're playing and the noise is there. But theoretically, when you're playing, it's you're totally focused on playing.
What's the biggest crowd you've ever run out in front of?
Was at Wembley in the first one against Bolton. I think we were 47,000.
Cool.
Yeah, but it doesn't look so well in Wembley because it holds 100,000, so it's basically half full. It's great to see John because I haven't seen John for ages. He's been, we had a great season at Torquay, didn't we, John?
Yeah.
And he's just mentioned that about that season, 84. Derby knocked us out of the cup in the fourth round, which was Telford United. We were a non-league club, and we were the furthest non-league club to go, and we got beat at the baseball ground 3-2, and then they must have gone on and played you next.
Was it? A quarter-final.
Was it?
So yeah, the quarter-final.
And then the season after, you was at Plymouth, you came up, and I was at Wolves then, and we must have played against you again. 5 years later, we were both at Torquay, weren't we? And the last time, I was just mentioning earlier, the last time we were both in Plymouth, we're both lying on a treatment table having acupuncture, trying to get ready for Wembley, weren't we?
Yeah, trying to get fit. Yeah.
Did it work?
Well, I think it worked for Dean. It didn't work for me. But
it was always going to work for me. I said to John, look, John was the most honest player I've played with. He would never put his team in jeopardy, whereas, unfortunately, I would. and I would have played. I'd have gone out there with a broke neck. We went every day for a week, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. And I think to be fair, looking back, it wasn't what you're saying is right. But I actually it was to get fit for the York game, which was the last game of the season, which I did do. And then unfortunately, I think the acupuncture that I was having was for my back because I tweaked my back. I actually pulled a hamstring in the last game, which put me out of everything else, which was disappointing because I played 46 games and then missed the two playoff games in Wembley.
Mm. Yeah, it was tough because, like you say, I felt for John that day because he played 46 games. I think it was Chris Curran who came in your place, Chris, didn't he?
Yeah,
I think
Chris
had only played a couple of games, hadn't he?
Yeah.
And he scored the unfortunate own goal, which nobody would ever see and never do again. It actually hit the crossbar, come back out onto the 6-yard box, and as he's gone to clear it, it's hit his standing foot and gone back in his own net. They do happen, especially to young lads when they're a bit inexperienced, but he'd done all right.
It was nice though, because like we had the penalty situation, obviously, and then the first man up was Mark Loram, and I thought, Loram does miss penalties. And he went and missed, and I was like, wow, how does that work? if you had any money and you had your mortgage on it, you'd put Loram to score.
Yes.
And he went and missed.
Well, the funny thing was about that situation was that you'd played Doncaster about 3 weeks earlier, 4 weeks earlier, and I was injured again, funnily enough, and I was sitting in the jacuzzi in one of the gyms in Torquay, and you'd played Doncaster, and I think you got beat 3-2, and Laws missed a penalty, and Joycey missed a penalty. And then we played Northampton a couple of weeks later, and I said to Laws, do you fancy this? And he said, no. I said, well, I'll have it, because I was on for my hat-trick. So I took it and scored. Yeah. And then when it came to Wembley, he didn't fancy it.
He didn't.
And I just picked the ball up. I said, I'll have this. The funny thing is, I scored, and then when I went back in the dressing room at half-time, John Impey said to me, if you'd have missed that, you'd be sitting by me now. And I thought, it's a bit harsh, that is, really. I've just got him into the lead and he's telling me that I shouldn't have took the penalty.
Yeah.
Listen, one of my greatest friends stayed with us at the weekend. His name, Simon Weston, CBE, and his wife, Lucy. It's a difficult marriage because he's Man U and she's Everton. Now, I've got to ask, both your other halves, are they football fans?
She definitely isn't. She hasn't got a clue what's going on. Funny, she's been with me 24 years now, and to be honest with you, she knows probably more about football than most women now. She knows the players, the managers and everything like that, but yeah. I still don't think she understands the offside rule.
No, my wife does. Yeah. And don't ask, because you'll get lectured, okay? It's from where it's played, isn't it? That's the offside rule.
There you go.
You see, yeah, I like that. And Mrs. Hughes,
yeah, Nicola, she likes a game of football. Yeah, she'll go. We go to Argo regular. So,
one fan of a particular club or.
No, I don't think so. I think Plymouth would be our team, so okay. Yeah, we haven't really got an outside team. Plymouth is our team.
Okay, well, let's go and meet Everton, don't mention the points, and Man United, don't mention Man City. It always fascinated me when a husband and wife team have different allegiances. I'm sat here with Lucy and Simon Weston. First of all, Lucy, your team?
The Blues, Everton, obviously, from the right side of Liverpool.
Yeah, not the best season so far.
Not the best seasons for quite a while, but this one now, been a bit of a disaster with all the points being taken off.
Look, there will be better times around the corner and a brand new stadium.
Yeah, let's hope we can fill it and not in the Championship. Let's hope we stay up this season. I think we will. I think we'll just about manage it.
Okay, what happens on match day when Man United are playing? Should we go over to the Man United expert who sat in the room with us?
Did you want an answer off me then?
Yeah, no, we'll edit that bit out. Yeah.
Or was it just the stare I gave my husband?
That was a very noisy stare, Simon.
It was a bit, yeah, he was cutting.
Why do you support Man U?
Oh, it goes way back to when I was a child. There was a guy in the back lanes where my grandmother lived. And he used to force all us kids to support Chelsea. He was bigger and older. Georgie Best was playing. George Best played at Stamford Bridge, and it was on TV. It was this grainy, murky sort of afternoon black and white TV then. And he just ran around Chelsea and scored.
Yeah.
And I realised that you didn't have to be big to be successful or tough or whatever. And I went out and I punched Mark Price in the mouth. And I realised then that, you know, you can be anything you want to be. George Best taught me that I could stand up for myself, so a bit of a silly story in a sense, but yeah, it just made me realise that I could be what I wanted to be without worrying about it.
Well, the world of football, we've been talking about it this weekend. You've come down to stay in Devon, but finance, some things just don't add up. And it really is weird. Let's not go too legally into the side of this, but...
No, but football finance is got to be one of the shadiest, murkiest, grey areas. How can you spend £1 billion and not fall foul of the rules? How can you be falling foul of the rules for 12, 14 years and never be pulled up for it? And then they go and change the rules so you don't have to be pulled up for it. Some people make mistakes like the way that Everton have fallen foul of the rules. It was a mistake, and yeah, it wasn't a deliberate ploy to sort of cheat people. But the way you look at it and the way that they're administering things is just wrong. But then again, the world is full of poor leadership, and the way it's all gone towards that football aspect is down to poor leadership and leadership from the authorities. And literally, that's where everybody's frustration in the country is coming from, for lots of different reasons. And it is down to poor leadership. And nobody believes or trusts anybody in these high places any longer. And I feel sorry for Evan. I really genuinely do. And Forrest. Yeah, no, not that sorry that I'm gonna weep buckets if you get relegated.
I think I'm surprised that Everton even got any points docked. I didn't know we had that much money to get charged with anything.
In fairness, I say we, because I follow Everton as well, we've got to have some points to have them docked in the first place.
I think you're right there, Fitz. Yeah, just it sticks in your throat a bit when you see the bigger clubs still up the top there and nothing seems to be happening to them, and then it's always like the little man at the bottom always getting a bit of a kick in, and yeah, it just really doesn't seem that fair. Let's hope that, you know, things change and everyone gets their comeuppance.
Well, according to the latest press release, that is it for this season, but there might be more deductions next season. Did you read that?
Yeah, I read something, but it's like, how many more points can we get taken off us?
Yeah.
You know? But if it's going to happen, let's get it done at the beginning of the season and then we can work our way, you know, back up rather than it being halfway through the season.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't know whether you're coming or going then. And it's got to have a detrimental effect on the players on the pitch every week, you know, wondering what's happening the week after. So if it's going to happen, let's get it done at the beginning of the season and that be it, be okay. over and done with.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit like that saying, isn't it? You know, the old sort of little ditty, it's the same the whole world over in life of crying shame. It's the rich what gets the pleasure and the poor what gets the blame. And it kind of feels like that right now. It just feels like that. You know, everybody seems to side with one or another, and everybody's being kept divided by the way people are governing things, and everybody's being segregated, and everybody's being pushed into silos, to into different camps, and whether it be politically in footballing world or whether it be around the globe, whatever people are doing, they always seem to want to keep people at each other's throats instead of people being unified. And I kind of hope that at some point unification of thought processes and people comes together, and they can get rid of all of these charlatans, you know, because you just look at the way things go and the people at the top are just getting richer.
Yeah,
you know, and the people that are down the bottom are getting penalized, and the fans who go to the grounds and they go to the games and they pay lots of their hard-earned money, when you look at the percentage of their wages that they put into football, is quite a large sum, and yet they're not getting anything back for it. And the way that they're getting treated as well is just shocking. I just think that people are getting taken for granted, you know, and they're pushing prices up and up and up and up on everything. And people are getting less in return for it. And I just think that something has to give, and we have to stop big business, because that's what football's become, big business. We have to stop big business forcing the ordinary person from enjoying what was once a working class sport enjoyed by people who just walked up to a parkside and enjoyed what they watched. You know, you look at rugby. Rugby's become unsustainable almost because of the costs and the lack of people going to games and the prices of having to go up, you know.
That's it, isn't it? Without, you know, without your fans, there wouldn't be these clubs. You know, without your fans turning up every week, week in, week out, and spending their hard-earned cash, buying the merchandise, taking their kids along. You know, without them, you wouldn't have your big clubs. You wouldn't have any clubs, you know.
Yeah, having attended Premiership game this year, and at the end, booing from the fans, you suddenly think, ooh, this is not the atmosphere.
We saw what it was like during COVID, you know, when there were no fans in the grounds. It was, and football just lost all its allure to me, because it was just no noise and celebration. And you could be at the park and watch people run around and kick a ball, and you can hear what's being said. But when, without the fans in the grounds, it loses all that sparkle. Mm. And I
think the governing body seem to have forgotten a little bit about it, without the fans, you know.
Sorry, you mentioned FIFA, and I've got an allergy now. I do apologise, FIFA, but you bring me out in a rash.
It's your hives again, is it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. I know what you're talking about there. It is. What happens on match day when Everton and Man U meet? I mean, do you separate?
Oh, yeah, I sit in one room and he sits in another, and one of us usually ends up crying. So.
And I can guess which one.
Yeah, yeah, Simon. Even if Everton have lost.
Oh, dear, yeah. When was the last time you two met then? Not you two, but Everton and Man U?
Earlier on this season, I think. I think we won 2-0, I think.
Of course you did. Always.
Yeah. Right, okay, let's end the conversation there. It's a pleasure to talk to both of you. And good luck with the stadium.
Is that before there's a fight?
Yeah, I'll lose. I'll lose, willingly lose.
Do you want to see a grown man cry?
Yeah, I'd lose a lot more than just the fight.
Got to stitch him back on first.
My thanks there to Simon and Lucy Weston, and let's just leave it there for the moment. I happen to know great friends of mine. They will have to remain nameless. One is Everton, one is Liverpool. And they will separate. One will go upstairs and one will go downstairs. But any problem is that who has the controller? And you can find that out, because when one scores, they'll switch over. Children, stop it. And we were mentioning 84. Who won in the end, the FA Cup?
Everton.
Yeah.
Yeah, Everton beating team we lost to, Watford.
Yeah, done it five times. 1907, 33, 66 is the one they always forget. 84 and 95. Now, someone's going to prove me wrong, but not to worry. Have you
Did you ever play against Everton? Or have you been to Everton?
Yeah, we played Everton one year in the Cup. It was amazing. We were down at Home Park. We were winning. Everybody thought we were going through. And then somebody handballed it.
Oh.
Not me, but somebody handballed it. And then they give a... Obviously, that's a penalty. They equalise. And as I was walking off the pitch, Trevor Stevens says to me, says, "Your pitch is rubbish." And I said... Rubbish? I said, "It's a great pitch. What are you on about?" And then when we went up to Everton and the replay, I realised what he meant.
Right.
Because our pitch had, it was beautiful grass on the wings, but in the middle it was quite muddy at the time. Not like today's pitches. Yeah, when we went up to Everton, it was like a billiard table and they beat us 4-0.
I have to say, I have met several groundskeepers and they are fantastic, fastidious.
I love groundsmen. I mean, they are. They're so protective over their pitches. And when we were at Wolves, we used to train on there. We used to have a little half an hour on a Friday. And the groundsman, Bill Pilbeam, used to say, "You can go on if I can join in." So he used to come in on his hobnailed boots and, like, the manager would be going, "Keep away from the players." He'd maim anybody. And then at the end of a training session, we'd have a fiver to hit the crossbar. Andy Much got in with this Bill Pilbeam. He's put against Bill Pilbeam. Much he missed. Bill toe-bunted it with his hobnail boots on and it went bosh straight off the bar and come back again. You've never seen nothing like it, but it was just hilarious and it was brilliant. But they are so protective of their pitches. So protective.
Yeah. Actually, I must admit, I will tell you this. I'll probably get into trouble for it, but I was watching my local rugby team in Plymouth. And they just got the scrum going nicely. Suddenly there was, "Hold it, hold it!" And everyone stood up because the Navy trained some of their dogs on the pitch. Oh. You can guess. And about 10 minutes later, the ref went, "Hold it, hold it!" I said, "Not again. Was the dog on Auberan?" Dirty boy. How are you both? I mean, you're of a certain age, both of you. You're both still looking fantastic. Physically fit?
Physically fit. Yeah. Looks better than what it feels like. Yeah, I'm okay. I'm doing all right.
Even after your injury, we have to mention the injury. No side effects, no?
Well, I mean, you say side effects. I don't do the things that I used to do to put me in danger anymore. So I don't get any real trouble with it. When the cold weather comes, yes, you get a few aches and pains, but nothing to speak of considering the amount of damage that was done.
Well, yeah, I don't want to harp on this and I don't want to get you in any sort of hot water, but can you just briefly describe what happened? Because I know you can tell us the story and I'd feel more comfortable that way.
The game itself, Torquay United were playing Brentford. We got ourselves a corner and on this occasion I decided to stay back as it was. I didn't go up for the corner to score. So I was basically on the halfway line just waiting to see if any breaks had come and basically as a defender stop them. And I have to say that I only remember this because I've seen it on video. I don't remember the incident because I was knocked out. But I can talk through what I remember seeing on the video, which was a corner to us, the ball gets cleared. Basically, there was one bounce on the centre circle and I go to win the header and I won the header, but in the meantime that Brentford player ran out and he's just gone right through me like a dose of oats and I've ended up in a big heap on the floor. So yeah, and I was knocked out completely. And the story is told in the press enough.
Yeah.
The damage was done. He's caught me and that's the easiest way I can say it, really. And I can't really...
No, we're not going to go too far into it because I don't want to bring anything up. You know, it's ever been unconscious? Because I tell you what, so strict rules these days. Football, rugby, any sport. Head injuries, you're off.
Let me tell you this, Fitz. I played with John and I played with some real tough, hard players. And John was one of them. There was Nicky Marker, Sean Tan, all Devon boys. And to be honest, they were 100% go through brick walls, and I mean brick walls. And John will tell you, I mean, I scored quite a few headers considering I didn't like to get involved in the roughy-toughy stuff. I was more fleet of foot. That season, we played Northampton and a ball bounced in the box and I saw John come from nowhere through a ruck of boots and elbows and everything. He just stuck his head in and bossed straight in the net, didn't you? Mm. That particular injury, do you know what? I'm sure I played in it, but I just can't recall. I remember seeing the incident, but I don't know whether I was playing in it or whether I'd come back to watch it because I was playing for somebody else. But I remember the incident and I thought, there's no way that would have happened to me because I wouldn't have gone to win the ball. Mm. But John did, and that was his job. He was a defender and he wanted to try and win balls. But I mean, I've seen centre forwards go to flick balls on and get smashed in the side of the head. I mean, a lad had it when I was playing for a certain team and he got banged in the head and he fractured his jaw and his nose and all this, that and the other. But my worst injury was we played up at Grimsby and Sean Cunnington caught me on my calf and I didn't really think a lot of it. Coming back, Norman Medhurst, our physio, said, look, do you know, I've got a feeling what this might be, but he didn't tell me. He said, but when you get up in the morning, don't eat anything. And I didn't think nothing of it. So I got up next morning, got into the ground, and I am starving. So the apprentice was in training, so I've gone in their dressing room and took one of the sandwiches and had a sandwich at their tuck box. So Norman's took me up the hospital. Right, he said, now you sure you haven't had anything to eat? I went, well, I have actually. And he went nuts at me and said, right, you're going to have to come back and come back again. But I'd ruptured my calf and I didn't know.
Oh.
So I ended up in the Mount Stuart Hospital and they said I was only going to be in for 10 days, something like that. So they've wheeled me down to the operating theatre. They've put two needles by my knee, two needles by my ankle. And I'm counting now thinking, one, two, three, I'm going out. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to sleep. He went, no, you're not. Anyway, I could feel them actually cutting my calf. So they cut the calf, sewed me up, and then I'm in the private hospital and the steak coming in and there's fresh cream cakes and everything. I'm watching the TV and I woke up in the night and I pulled the blankets back and my calf was black. And the doctor came and he said, I've got to rush you back in. He said,
all right.
And I was out for 4 months. But that was my worst injury. I've still got the 6-inch scar now.
Yeah. It is. I mean, obviously with injuries, I think in general terms, you know that you're going to get something. You know, you pull a hamstring or you get a knock and it takes a few weeks to settle down and you're back playing again. And I think those sort of things you accept because that's part and parcel. And it's unfortunate sometimes and it's very frustrating because it hit you at any time. And you don't know, do you? Because you're going into a game, you don't know when you're going to get a kick or a strain or whatever. So, you know, when I look back, the injury is severe. When it's severe, it's the recovery time. Look, it took me 12 months to actually just recover from that injury. And then they tell me I've got to have another operation because I had a plate put in my cheek. So in order to play, they said to me that I have to have the plate removed because if I have a similar sort of injury again, metal in your face is no good, so you have to take it out. So unlike, you know, if you have that when you break your leg, you have plates put in. Sometimes you can keep them in. But in your face, obviously, it's a lot more because you've got eyes and all the rest of it. So, and that can be dangerous with metal in there. So literally 12 months after I'd done it, I had to have the plate. And I think the second operation was worse than the first one because you know what's coming and you know the pain that you're going to go through, which is quite severe. So, yeah, and then you have a recovery period of that. And then I think I played two games for Torquay Reserves. No, actually, I played one game for Torquay Reserves and I played one game at Weymouth. And I just knew right away, you know, I'm not doing the things that, like Dean says, before I would be able to just go into a melee of players. I'm not bothered because I know that I'm just attacking the ball, trying to win the ball. And I'm all of a sudden thinking, I don't really want to go in there anymore.
I can understand.
Yeah.
That.
And also, after games, I was getting headaches and wasn't really recovering very well. So I decided to call it a day.
Yeah. I think if you take the positive out of it, though, John, I mean, you were on the wrong side of 30. When it happened, it could have happened early in your career.
Oh, God, yeah.
and finished you, you know. Absolutely, so it was good that, in a way, that it came at the end of your career rather than at the beginning. Because if that had happened at the beginning of your career, you'd have probably never played again.
Yeah, well, yeah, the similar situation, isn't it? I mean, whether you're 22 or 32, you don't play again. And at 22, that's your career gone, isn't it? You don't get to do all the things that I was able to do. So you're right. From that angle, I was 32. But, you know, when I'm 32 and you're fit, you still think you're going to play until you're 35, 36. Yeah. And that's important at that time. Mm. I think you've hit on it before, when you don't really know when you're going to finish. But then to arrive to a football match and after 15 minutes get injured and never play again, really, at that level, that's after 12, 14 years, that's... I've been to very dark places thinking about that, and it's not very nice. It's not very nice.
Look, let's leave it there. John, thank you for your honesty. It's been great to see you again, and you, Dino, as well. And also to Simon and Lucy. So they were down at the weekend, but they left. They're still talking, apparently.
And Pablo.
Pablo has not made an appearance this week, yeah. Pablo! No, he's asleep. This has been Back on the Ball with me, David Fitzgerald, John Uzel and Dean Edwards, brought to you courtesy of Greenwood Accountancy and also Wallen Solicitors. We'll see you very soon.
Quiet, Pablo.